Channel one over.
This is channel one over. Channel one over. After lunch on November 26th, I'm talking about Judy. It's channel one over. It's a continuation of the talk on Judy and the tilt.
Let's see.
Yeah, you couldn't sort of explain an idea. For instance, Celia could read the books on dressage and get something out of them and put it into practice. And maybe that's going a little bit far, because those books on dressage are like an engineer's manual. They're technical.
Yeah.
But Judy could read them and come out with the most confused idea of what the author had said. And she took a course over at Stoneley. And what they had to do, it was the course for the instructor's exam, because her parents were pushing her to take that exam. And she had to do, besides writing instruction she was getting, she had to prepare a lecture on how to teach or on the aid for a certain movement in dressage. So she got out the books and she decided to find out how to do it, because Judy is no great dressage writer. And she went through all the books, and then she came to talk it out with Celia, and I overheard some of the little chats they had. And some of the misconceptions she had about what she thought those books meant. And she lived around horses all her life. And she lived around dressage all her life. I think the worst thing she could have done was to look into a book.
But she's not dumb, she just wasn't bookish.
Well, she was taught to the horse's leg, bandaging. She was told to always bandage it on the outside of the horse's leg. And I don't know what happened in between the time she was taught to bandage and when we were working that day. But we were bandaging up a horse for travel. And I was working along, and I had my bandage done, and I tied it on the inside of the leg. And Judy was working away, and she looked over, and she looked at my bandage, and she says, "Barbara, you are about to take your AI, and you still don't know how to bandage a horse's leg. Don't you know that you aren't supposed to ever have the tape on the tied on the inside of the horse's leg?" And I said, "Well, Judy, I don't know. In the book it said not to tie it on the front or on the tendon. It looks to me like that's what you've done." And I looked up, and the woman that owned the horse was standing in the door. And Judy kind of gave me a glare, and she says, "Well, I'll retie mine if you'll retie yours." It was chatter some of the time. But every once in a while, you get in something really good. It was at lunch that she talked to, well, I don't know, I guess it was down in the club room. But she'd come through with some of her experiences. See, she didn't stay in school. She left school as soon as she could and went down and worked on the barges. She says that she was fresh back from that when I saw dinner. She was barge woman tilt.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. And what it was, she'd gone down to work on the canal boats of some friends of the tilt. He'd been a doctor or a lecturer or something. And he and the tilt had gone on a couple of summers on holiday on the canal. And he and his wife were so taken with life on the canal that he just quit his job and bought two canal boats And during the summer, he would take tourists on tours of the canals, and during the winter, they just lived off of what they made during the summer. Judy went down there to work for him. And she was
now they were friends of the family.
Yeah, they were friends of the family.
And she was all in the family.
Yeah. But she was a hostess and lock keeper and crew and everything else. And she used to have to start off the day. She said that she'd have to get up about, I don't know what time she had to get up. Pretty early, though. And first thing she'd have to do would be to go, all the bedrooms were on the first boat, and all the kitchen and lounge were on the second boat. So she'd go back to the second boat and get the tea. And have a tray full of tea, all those tea services for all the guests, and have to get that across the boats between one boat and another. And she said when she first started that, she didn't think you could do things like that. I landed up in the water. That was the some of the things she talked about on the canals. Wow, good fun. And there was once they went, what she really liked to do was on, have an evening, they had their evenings free. And they would go down to one of the inns, one of the pubs, on the canal. And stay up till 1 or 2 o'clock at night, just sitting around, drinking beer, and talking with all the other barge people. She never drank ale before or since, but she did then. And you could see it made her feel pretty big. Think she'd just been right in there with them.
She was 20?
19 then. 18 or 19 then.
You know, she'd already had a taste of life, hadn't she?
Yeah.
And she didn't have a bunch of pastel books joggling her.
Somehow I can never imagine Judy letting a book joggle her mind.
Now, you couldn't get much out of her on your level, but she could handle the children.
Yeah, she had a way with the children. She'd cuss them out, and she was hard. We would just weep for them if we knew she was in a bad mood. She would take it out on them.
Is that right?
She'd get up again there in the gallery, and they could do nothing right.
Yeah.
I don't know. If I'd been a kid, I think I would have left her lessons in tears sometimes.
Yeah.
But then when she was in the mood, she could think up the most marvelous things for them to do. And she had the energy to get in there and find games for them and set them up, and that took a lot of work. You had to get equipment into the school and rearrange jumps and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And one lesson she gave, a lesson on side saddle, riding side saddle. And she brought in a horse with a side saddle on, and they let some of them ride actually in a side saddle. And then she says, but you don't need this. And she had them just simply drop one stirrup and ride in ordinary saddle as if they were riding side saddle. And then she did what I would never have had the courage to do. She made them canter that way. And if some of them fell off, well, they'd pick themselves up and get back on. That was just part of the fun. I would have been scared to death one of them would have broken its neck and I'd been sued or something, but she didn't worry.
That brings her to life. Now that's more like the family riding school. that, you know, you feel that you're lucky to get in on. Is that right?
Well, you feel you're lucky to get in on it when you can talk about it. Being there, you get too messed up in other people's most problems. Especially in not just the family's problems, though you do. There was a big feud between Judy and Celia. Just constant. And sometimes it would blow up into just huge battles in the middle of the yard. Verbal battles. And both of them had voices that could carry a mile. And Judy would start in on, usually it started with something between about Sonata and Corey. Sonata was Judy's horse and Corey was Celia's, and Corey was beautiful. And Sonata was permanently lame. And that was enough right there. And Celia would say something about Sonata, and usually she was pretty, you know, easy about it. She never rode Judy about Sonata being lame or anything. But then Celia would say, "Well, I can't do something because I've got to work with Corey." And Judy would say, "Well, you're always paying attention to your horse. You never have time to do anything." And that would be the start of it. And it would finally end with Judy off saying, tramping off and saying, "Well, you can take care of your damn horse, and that's it, you know." And oh, they get loud before they got to that point. And when you got clients on the yard, you just sort of brush them under the carpet. Say, "Go have your family feud someplace else." And of course, we get mixed up in it too. You can't help it. You take sides.
You take sides?
Yeah. I usually sided with Celia, and I usually didn't take a vocal side. I didn't ever interfere. But even so, you get mixed up with it. There's one time it was really rough, and that was when Celia just got sick. So Judy was so interested in making money out of the place. And she would just...
Oh, yeah.
She decided that Celia was lazy and inefficient and just not paying enough attention to running the school properly. Well, some of it was true. And that made it worse. And she would tell Celia what she thought of how she was running things. And she would come in and complain because there wasn't enough tack or something like that. And she said, "Judy, see, you really ought to go out and buy some tack. It's ridiculous for a school like Windmill Hill to not have the proper tack. Or, see, you should do this. Or, the students should go hunting. It's ridiculous for a school like this not to offer the proper thing." And Celia would get mad, and she finally decided she was just going to quit. She was through. She'd had enough. Well, she didn't bother to tell us that she'd had enough. And we all knew how Judy felt about things. And Elaine had just gotten her AI and was really feeling big. And Elaine was obnoxious enough without having that puffing her up. So Celia was in tears for about 2 or 3 days. And her boyfriend told us, "Watch out, Judy's going to take over the school as of Monday." And we all went, "Ugh, you don't mean it." And he did. Well, we didn't understand how the lay of the land, because we all knew how devoted Celia was to that school and to the horses. And we couldn't see her quitting. The only way we could see was that Judy and Elaine had pushed her out. So as a result, none of us spoke to Judy or Elaine. None of us would take orders from Judy or Elaine. We all went in circles and laughed when they couldn't operate the cedar, the oat crusher, and didn't know how to get the feed, and began to run into all those little problems of how to run the place that they hadn't had to deal with before because Celia had taken care of it. And it was real rebellion. Elaine didn't have a chance. She'd tell us to do something, we'd just simply stand there and curse her out. She never got anywhere. And that made her worse. She'd really get heavy-handed then. This was just authority, you know, she'd just gotten. And Judy thought that we were all being sassy. And one nun was glaring at us from odd corners. And Celia was in tears the whole time. And then she went into seclusion, and we didn't see her for about 3 days. And all this time, not a word from the house, not a word from the tilt. So we got together. All the students got together and decided that we couldn't take it. That either the tilts gave us an explanation or we left. And one of the girls, wrote a note to Celia on our day off. Now, on our day off, I went home with Jane and her parents. And Jane explained the situation to her mother, and her mother decided she would write Mrs. Tilt. And I declared my intention that if I didn't get an explanation by the next day, because we'd already decided that I was going to go up and talk to the tilt, since I was the only one over 21. I was the oldest one. And the only one that was really, I could leave if I wanted to. I mean, there was nothing to keep me there if I decided I wanted to leave. Others had parents and all sorts of other things to make them stay, but I didn't. And I decided I was, if something didn't get straightened out, I was going to go out and have a talk with the tilt. And great courage on my part, you know. one of the girls, I was at Jane's, one of the other girls wrote a note to Celia. So the next day, I got the word that I needn't bother to go up to see the tilts, that Celia wanted to see us sometime that day. And I'd just wait. So she came in, she said, I've got to apologize to you all. I got sick of the whole thing, and I decided I wanted to quit. And I should have given you an explanation. But now I've decided things have been straightened out, and I've decided I'll take back my job as head girl. And I'll put Elaine in her place. I didn't realize what was going to happen. I didn't realize that Judy was going to have to pal up with Elaine to be able to do this. I told her she could run it and she could do it, as long as but I didn't expect her to involve somebody else in it. And so Elaine got put in her place. And everything was quiet and happy for about a month. It didn't get that bad again. But when you get in it was horrid. You just felt rotten, or at least I did. I can't go gloriously into battle. I get too involved in the other side.
How do you figure the tilk stayed out of it quiet that long? Nothing they could do.
Well, Celia said that she had told her father
yeah.
that she would handle this and he was not to get involved in
yeah.
it. Well, they didn't get involved in it until a letter from Jane's mother came. But
Robert takes Celia. Now she could understand what is going on in the horses.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So she was your chief teacher.
Mm-hmm. We had her for almost all our lessons. And she was good. She was not particularly imaginative. And she didn't like to put in more energy than she had to. Which was sort of reflected in the school. In the fact that there were not a lot of competitions or chances for us to go hunting or go outside the school or things like this. But she was still a good instructress. And though it was hard to get her to come work with you outside of a lesson, it was a matter of sort of seeing her go past the door and yelling at the right moment. And she would come in and help you. She had nothing against it. It was just that you couldn't plan for her. Because she'd get off with Mike and that would be it. You were through. She didn't have the sort of dedication that makes a great teacher. But she had the knowledge. And she had the tolerance. Teach well. She would work with you and you wouldn't feel that you were being told something so absolute that there was no discussing it. Mm-hmm. She worked almost entirely on position and it was hard to define, except that her lessons and her father's were so remarkably different. For one thing, I know what part of it. Well, what it was she always directed her instructions to one person. For instance, Barbara, your back's too stiff. Or Barbara, use your inside leg and push your horse out on the circle more. Always it was the instruction was for the moment and for the actual what was actually happening. And then if you ask her a question, for instance, well, why can't I get him out on the circle? Then she could give you the answer. And if you ask her about the answer, she could go in and do it deeper. Just as far as you wanted to go. Mm-hmm. And you always knew that she was considering the horse you were riding and was actually... Her knowledge, it wasn't just vague, abstract knowledge, and it wasn't just something picked up from just watching that one horse. It was backed by, you know, all this theory. And all sound. I could trust what she said. And her father's lessons, he almost never said anything to one particular rider. Almost always, he would talk in general terms. And he would give... People used to complain, especially people who weren't interested in dress size. They say, I don't want to go to Mr. Tilt's lesson. It's cold night. It's 32 degrees out here or less. And we'll just stand in the school and freeze while he talks. And I found it fascinating. And then if you ask him a question about the problem you were having with your horse, at that particular moment, at that particular time, he would help you. But mainly he talked about the theory. And he could give the theory and the reason behind everything that you've been working on, for instance, with Celia or Judy.
Oh.
And they were really what almost like master classes in violin or piano. Whereas somebody else gives you all the work on technique. He gave you the work on interpretation. He never said anything like, very rarely said anything like, your hands are too low, your hands are too high. He would say, your horse is doing something. And he said he almost never looked at the rider. And this is the difference. He would watch the horse, and he said, I can tell what the rider is doing wrong by what the horse is doing. And so, whereas Celia's instructions might be, loosen your rein and allow your horse to put his head down, Mr. Tilt would say, your horse is carrying his head too high, or your horse is resisting. Give more, or something like that. And I always rode better in Mr. Tilt's lessons. You could see the difference. I would start out riding and having trouble, and for instance, in Celia's lessons, I'd never been able to get Spangles to keep his head still. And Mr. Tilts would choose one thing like that and give a whole hour and a half lesson on it. And he did this one day. He gave a lesson on getting your horse to accept the bit. And within 20 or 30 minutes after we started, Spangle's head did not move. And I could never do it again. In spite of the fact that I had done it under him, and now supposedly knew what it was he was after and what it was he did to get me to do it. And he didn't say he didn't ever talk specifically to me. Never once did he say, Barbara, do this, as opposed to anybody else.
Yeah.
And yet, that horse went beautifully that night. And I could never quite do it again, except for a very short time. And there were several little lessons like that, where he would just work on one thing, and finally you would think, oh, I see what you're talking about. I really got it. I mean, the horse would really be doing it. And you wonder, well, why on earth can I do this all the time, you know? And he would never raise his voice. This was one of the things. If Mr. Tilt got angry, there must be a heck of a lot wrong. He'd never raise his voice. Almost never. Now, sometimes, occasionally, he would. But if he did, you knew that something was really wrong. That he was put out because you hadn't been paying attention. And
he had a good full voice.
He did, but he had trouble realizing that he wasn't using it sometimes because he couldn't really hear. When he knew that he was, when he thought about it, his voice would carry. But he got so that he'd set up a PA system.
Yeah.
And he got so that his clients complained a little bit, so he got so he used that most of the time. The worst thing was that while he would talk about all the theory and everything, and you could hear him quite clearly, he would say something like, now, the horse going in a circle, just remember that he keeps the inside, you want to keep the now on keeping the quarters to the inside, now go off on the right rein to the walk march. And you've been listening so much to all this stuff about what the horse is doing that you missed the command of what to do completely. And if you were leading file, you would just, several times I was caught completely. You know, I had the faintest idea of what he wanted to do.
He shift pretty fast.
He would shift so you wouldn't even realize he'd done it. He would be in the middle of his explanation, and the next thing you'd do, he would be repeating a command with this sort of tone in his voice that says, why didn't you hear it the first time? I think that's one reason he started using the PA system.
That's channel one over,
and a report on the Judy and Celia mostly Judy, and they work things out publicly, and this is 3:55, channel one over, 3:55, channel one over, Wednesday afternoon, full Thanksgiving, 26th of September, 69, Wednesday afternoon, 3 o'clock, the 26th of November, just before Thanksgiving, 1969.
Now that was, on CBS.
This is a little human interest thing. So.
Yeah. Well, that's our old friend.
I can't remember his name, but there he is.
And Carousel and
the No, that picture that merry-go-round just brought back that carousel in Stratford so clearly. They had what they called an Edwardian steam festival. And what it was they simply brought in a fair. But all the rides were run by old steam engines. And most of the, not all the rides, but most of them were old, beautiful things. And they had, all around the edge, they had the calliopes, steam calliopes, German and French, most of them, with the moving figures and the gilt paint and the bright colors and that marvelous calliope music. And we went out a whole group of us. It's a little Eric, the Belgian boy, and Jane, and myself, and Trudy. Went to the fair, and the most carefree night. And we got there, and we had to go clear the other side of Stratford to park. We walked back and...
Oh, you mean it's crowded?
Yeah, it was crowded. Well, we didn't want to park too close to the fair because we didn't want to run the risk of anybody getting in the car. Not that anybody would have gotten into our old Ford, but that's all right. And we got to the fair, and the first thing you went down across the road. It was across the road from the theater. Across the park, and got across the street and walked down. And on one hand, on one side was the cotton candy, on the other side was the fortune teller. And we wandered on in, and Jane was mad about these twisty rides, and she wanted to try them all. So we went on some of the car rides, and we really hadn't got a chance to look around. I mean, we went straight onto this car ride, and we were rolling around.
I never went on a twisty ride.
Well, these are those silly cars that go round and round the same time they're going on the big circle.
Yeah, and swing you.
And swing, yeah. And... I don't know. I don't get much thrill out of them anymore. I don't know. I guess I just think about it in too rational a way.
But Jane did.
Oh, Jane loved them. Any sort of thing like that.
Yeah.
And then we went on another ride, and heaven knows how we managed to miss the carousel. But it wasn't until we'd been on about three rides and turned around, and there it was. Now, it was right in the middle of that fair. And it was a great, big, huge one. And it was as ornate as it could be. Just gold all over it. And all the top of it, the roof of it, was blue with stars on top of it. And the flag at the top, and it had horses and camels and what was it? Oh, just anything you wanted to ride. Dogs and leopards.
I never saw anything but horses.
I know, this was the most fun. This was one that was made for. It was the sort you read about in children's books and see in the pictures and think, well, no real fair has that sort of carousel. I had a great big organ in the middle, on one side you could see the back and the works of the organ, and on the other side it was all painted in white and gold, and it had two figures, one on each side, and they moved with the music. And one of them, I think, was a clown, and the other was a lady of some sort, I forget.
Both riders.
Hmm? No, these were standing figures on the organ.
The clowns ride horses.
Sometimes.
Yes, I mean, they'd be appropriate figures, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
I enjoyed that.
And the lights, we couldn't resist it. Once I saw it, I couldn't resist it. And we went dashing over to ride the carousel. And it was like magic. It really was. The horses were just, all of them, beautiful. And wood horses, not any of their stamped animals. And all the woodwork, so fine, the beautifully carved wood and painted and bright colors and elaborate signs on the side that said that this carousel had been patronized by Her Majesty the Queen in 1904 or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
And all around the outside along the top there were big signs of this so-and-so's carousel, and then world famous and patronized by royalty. And just right. But I think...
Now, these weren't just the elder people who came to see that, like Florence's cane syrup mill.
Oh, no.
The children were just full of children.
Yeah, this was all the young people and all the... Well, not even... Mostly Stratford people. Wasn't even the tourists. It was a little early, I think, for the tourists, if I remember correctly. It was in June. And it was still cool in the night. Although it was always cool in the nights, but it was right nippy. So you brought out the best in you. And Jane and I went over and rode one of the swings. And it was my favorite ride. It was one of these rides that you're sitting and it gets faster and faster and you get higher and higher. And all you do is sit there. And the reason I liked it was you could see the carousel.
Oh, yeah.
And there was that carousel and all the lights, and it was unlike any other fair because it had the steam. The steam was rising from all those old steam engines that powered those things. And it would catch the light and make it foggy and misty. And is it Debussy, Bossuet? That's the written watching a fair from across the river or something like that.
Yeah.
That was it. It just
our friend was Charles Girault.
Yeah. Girl.
Now, you didn't have any contact with the Shropshire lad, Houseman.
No.
Have you ever had any contact with him? I'll have to read you a piece or two from that and see if you recognize the spirit of any of it over there.
Two things that had real magic. One of them was the carousel. And the other was the gypsy boy on one of the rides. And it was one of those rides that goes, what do they call it? It goes round, and the whole platform of the ride goes round the center. And it goes up and down as well. And it had different sorts of animals you could ride them in. It would feel like a horse cantering. And we rode it twice. And there was a gypsy boy taking money. And he was tall, and he wore dungarees that just fit like a skin. And a shirt that was rolled up, showed the tattoos on his arms, and it was unbuttoned and open at the collar. And his face was sort of thin, and long hair, and gray eyes. And he just would walk, that thing was moving fast, and he could just walk around it and move from one ride to another, and then step onto the still platform in the center, and all just so easy. And then when he'd step out onto the ride, the wind would catch his hair. And he was a wild, free spirit.
I don't know anybody. Now you see your little gypsy boy. And when I thought of you and Jane and Trudy and over there, I thought of a houseman's chaps, you know, at the Ludlow Fair. And now I think of these spirits like Johnny Sims and Johnny up here, who got Faye started in the horses. I don't know anyone who sees them and can report on them. I don't know anybody. And one of the mistakes I made when I came out here, I don't know how, you know, anyone who's bright and perceptive can make such basic, fundamental mistakes. You see, what I wanted to do, I came out here to do, was to live with in the countryside. And I got these damn registered cattle. You see, what I need to do is get some of these old mixed Bremens and white face, the mixed ones. And just what these fellows had, you see. I didn't want to be amongst the elite. I should have used my cattle business and the land out here, you see, to get into the countryside, what I call the countryside. Now your horses can cut you off. Certain attitude towards horses will cut you off from certain people, and it'll give you interest to others. Yes. But there's actually no, it shouldn't do that. I mean, you could take profit from my sad experience and not let it, not let it do that. But I don't know, you see, shift all the time with the people in mind. Now, I think it'd be a remarkable thing to, and you've got to have some access, you see. You got to be able to talk something that they talk. And horses, I think, would be one of the finest things because they're all just dedicated spirits, you see. So many of them, when it comes to horses, at least around here. Well, that'd open up all these people. Now, you say, in your particular case, you don't need to know them. Well, I didn't need to know them. But it's, I sure don't. I don't really have access to any of them. You see, when I came out here, that was several years ago, I had a great deal more vigor than I have now. And, see, my eyes got punctured, and that sort of slowed me down. and I'm doing too much desk work. Now, I'm not, I can't cope with the outdoors. I do too much desk work. You see, I don't know enough about it to defend it, you know, to give a defense, as Sidney says, you know, a poor defense with poor poison. But Houseman made something of it, you see, in the Shropshire Land. I don't think there's any difference. I mean, basically the same. You see, this is the way we have pursued a subject. We state a thesis like this, and it'll come out. They're not nervous. You see, Freud hasn't got them. And when they get up in the morning, they don't look around to see if everybody's for them or against them, you see. Now, that's right. In spite of the public schools, they still have a considerable amount of health. Now, that's after supper. That's after supper, Wednesday, the 26th of November, 27th, just before Thanksgiving. That's after supper, Wednesday, the 26th of November, 69. That's about 600. Channel 1 over, around 600. Channel 1 over, around 600. Wednesday after supper, 26th of November, 69. Morning, 28th of November.
This is Friday morning, 28th of November.
Friday morning, the 28th of November. This is Friday morning, 28th of November. Channel 1 over on 600. Channel 6 over on 1 over on 600. Exploring back in the woods.
Go ahead.
With Uncle Lynn and them. We saw 4 horseheads and rat snake. We saw plenty of birds. Then we came back and we went riding down to Bessie's house on the horses. And Sergey was so frisky, and we all had a good time with him. We had a little talk with Bessie, and then we came back and had a few races.
Oh, you did?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A snake child this late in the year?
It was dead.
About how'd you run into it?
We just looked there and saw him.
When
we were way back there over near the swamp. We saw 2 big ones over there at the orange grove yesterday.
Live?
Yes.
Alive. I found one up in the
They bed. Were real big, too.
What kind? You what?
Rat snakes.
I found one up in the tree.
Look at this, huh?
Found a rat snake up in the tree.
Where about that?
In an orange tree.
Where about that?
No, it was a tangerine tree.
Oh, yeah.
Where about that?
In Merritt's orange grove.
Oh, way down there.
Yeah.
I see. How'd your horses behave?
Oh, they've been behaving pretty well. They behaved pretty well this morning. I gave Molly a good combing. This morning.
Oh, did you?
Mm-hmm.
Sandy?
Way back a few months ago, up at our house, we had a lightning strike a tree. Then a few weeks later, the night when Daddy and Dad were ready to leave for Alaska and Daddy was coming home from across the ocean, we had a big storm and, knocked down 17 trees altogether and damaged them, and that means we had to cut down even more because the trees knocked down some, and we still have 3 more to cut down.
Well, you got any left?
Yeah, mm-hmm. We got a lot left.
Didn't get them all?
No.
Well, how you go about taking them down?
Well, it depends on if it'll hit the Carter's telephone line or not.
Say that again.
it depends on if you cut the trees down and it's gonna hit the Carter's telephone line.
Oh, Then what?
If it's not going to, you can just let it come down any old way, and if it's not going to hit any little tree. Yeah. If it's not going to hit the car, there's telephone line, and it's going to hit a little tree one way, then there's a whole clear place, then you let it come down that way.
Oh, you look for a clear place for it.
Yeah, you have to have it well balanced. And sometimes you have to take ropes and pull them the direction they have to go.
Ropes?
Mm-hmm. Real ropes. Say, a few days ago, about a week ago on a Friday, we cut down this tree, and it had been warped or something around it, and it came down, and Dad said it wouldn't. He couldn't make it go that way. Is good himself if he were guiding it.
Who's that now?
Die.
Yeah? Mm. You get him down?
With the power saw.
Oh. Do you use the power saw?
Yeah, he uses our power saw.
What's that? Right.
07.
Mm. Did he cut him up too?
Yeah, he cut some of them up if we're not going to use them on my cabin.
On your what?
Cabin.
Hadn't heard of that.
Well, I have cabin up there. By the time I finish it, it's going to be 17 by 5.
How far along are you?
Well, I've only gotten 8 foot by 5 so far. Have some more of it, of the 11 more feet, and the other 5 and the 9.
Well, how are you putting it up? I can't quite.
Well, you see, you make a flat place on the ground, then you put cinder blocks all on the sides of it.
Oh, you don't let the.
And then you start building and put the logs on. And there's still holes left in, but you fill that in with clay. And,
you got plenty of clay?
Yeah, down in the ground. And, the dirt with sand won't work on that, because as soon as you put it in, it'll just crumble all up.
Oh.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, what do you do with the logs?
The little ones that's cut. We pile them up and use them in the winter.
Well, I mean, how do you make your house out of your little ones?
Not the little ones. We cut them in special sizes. We cut them into special sizes.
And then lay them up?
Mm-hmm.
You have to, what holds them together?
Well, they just lay on each other.
Is that it?
Mm-hmm.
How do you tell which oranges to pull?
Well, he said to taste them, and he said the ones that were yellow were the best. And the tangerines, you have to pull them real carefully. You usually have to cut them off with a knife.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, because if you pull them off, the tops will usually come off, and they're no good after a couple of days.
They won't keep.
Mm-hmm. You pick the orange tangerines. And when we were up at Knoxville, we had that big storm. One of these trees came down and knocked the flagpole while Danny and Dow were in Alaska. And when he came back from Alaska, he had an idea to put it back up. He put it up with hinges. So when the big winds come, you can take it down.
Oh, how high is the flagpole? High the house?
It's higher than the house.
How high is the bracket for the hinges?
Well, you see, he takes this big bolt, and he has these holes in this board, and then he makes a hole in the flagpole all the way through. Then he makes another hole in the board, then another hole in the flagpole. Then he puts it the rest of the way in, and then he'll take a nut and put it on. So when the big winds come, you can take it down.
I'd like to see that. I never heard of that.
And the flagpole isn't in the ground, you know.
Not in the ground?
It's not on the ground. The flagpole part isn't, but the wooden part is.
I never heard of that.
Well, she went up to Estes Park in Alaska, you would have heard of it. You would see one.
Oh, is that where you got the idea?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you some about when Nanny and Dad went up to Alaska.
Let's hear a little.
Well, you see, this summer my grandmother and grandfather went up to Alaska. And they went all the way to Seattle in a car. Then by boat they went to Alaska. Then by airplane they went to this special place in Alaska. And then they had gotten off the airplane and went, and they stayed there for a few days. And they saw these big glaciers. And they were, then a few days after that, they were riding along on this train, and there was this thing about 1,000 feet deep altogether, and the water, it got down to about right here, and the water was 1,000 feet deep, 100 feet deep. And they kept going on, and they felt so horrible as that train got off the track. It'd really be something. They saw some more of these ice glaciers, and they saw icebergs and this water surrounded an island. And they went and saw the faces, you know, George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and those others.
Oh yeah.
And they went
South Dakota.
Yeah. And then they went up and they were on the highest big mountain top there is in the United States. Last year in 68 we went up to this little lake and we went fishing. And Shug was the first one to catch a fish. He caught a big bass. Then went in, caught a big old sunfish. Then we went on fishing. We ate supper. And by that time, that's a little bit after 6, we were about ready to go home. And at that time, we had about 59 fish. And in between there, we just kept a fishing and almost every little time you put your pole in, you'd have a fish.
Where was that?
I forget the lake's name. It's up in, it's about a 40-mile trip from Knoxville.
Yeah, that's all that.
Where it is. It's up in Crossville, Tennessee.
Oh, Crossville. Well, birdhouse, Marty, how'd you design that?
Oh, well, I didn't really design it. Well, Dad had this thing ready for his camera when he was going up to Alaska, and he decided he didn't want that one, so he built him another one, and he let me have that one, so I And so it had this little front like a four birdhouse. So I hammered back on, then hammered a flat top on it. Then I hammered a flat bottom on it with a little hole in it. So the bird could get some air. Like I say, you usually need.
But this is Dye was going to use for his camera?
Yeah.
What would that do? How would he use it with
his camera? He was going to put his camera stuff in it.
Oh, just to protect it?
Mm-hmm. I don't know what he was going to use it for.
Well, that's a good birdhouse.
Yeah, you're really right. It is a good birdhouse. Dad had this little thing. He was going to put his camera. Well, you see, Dad was going to use this for his camera to take to Alaska and take some pictures with. And